This is Reading the Classics. I'm Kelly Johnson from the Ketchikan Public Library, and I would like to share with you Hunting the Deceitful Turkey by Mark Twain. When I was a boy, my uncle and his big boys hunted with the rifle, the youngest Fred and I with a shotgun, a small single-barrel shotgun which was properly suited to our size and strength. It was not much heavier than a broom. We carried it turnabout half an hour at a time. I was not able to hit anything with it, but I liked to try. Fred and I hunted feathered small game. Others hunted deer, squirrel, wild turkeys, and such things. My uncle and the big boys were good shots. They killed hawks and wild geese and such like that on the wing, and they didn't wound or kill squirrels. They stunned them. When the dogs treed a squirrel, the squirrel would scamper aloft and run out on a limb and flatten itself along, hoping to make himself invisible in that way, and not quite succeeding. You could see his wee ears sticking up. You couldn't see his nose, but you knew where it was. Then the hunter, despising a rest for his rifle, stood up and took offhand aim at the limb and sent a bullet into it, immediately under the squirrel's nose, and down tumbled the animal, unwounded but unconscious. The dogs gave him a shake, and he was dead. Sometimes, when the distance was great and the wind not accurately allowed for, the bullet would hit the squirrel's head. The dogs could do as they pleased with that one. The hunter's pride was hurt, and he would not allow it to go into the game bag. In the first faint gray of the dawn, the stately wild turkeys would be stalking around in great flocks and ready to be sociable and answer invitations to come and converse with other excursionists of their kind. The hunter concealed himself and imitated the turkey call by sucking the air through the leg bone of a turkey, which had previously answered a call like that and lived only just long enough to regret it. There is nothing that furnishes a perfect turkey call except for that bone. Another of nature's treacheries, you see. She is full of them. Half the time she doesn't know what she likes best, to betray her child or to protect it. In the case of the turkey, she's badly mixed. She gives it a bone to be used in getting it into trouble, and she also furnishes it with a trick for getting itself out of the trouble again. When a mama turkey answers an invitation and finds she's made a mistake in accepting it, she does as the mama partridge does, remembers a previous engagement, and goes limping and scrambling away, pretending to be very lame. And at the same time, she is saying to her not visible children, "Lie low, keep still, don't expose yourselves. I shall be back as soon as I have beguiled the shabby swindler out of the country." When a person is ignorant and confiding, this immoral device can have tiresome results. I followed an ostensibly lame turkey over a considerable part of the United States one morning because I believed in her and could not think she would deceive a mere boy, and one who was trusting her and considering her honest. I had the single-barreled shotgun, but my idea was to catch her alive. I often got within rushing distance of her, and then made my rush, but always, just as I made my final plunge and put my hand down where her back had been, it wasn't there. It was only 2 or 3 inches from there, and I brushed the tail feathers as I landed on my stomach. A very close call, but still not quite close enough. That is, not close enough for success, but just close enough to convince me I could do it next time. She always waited for me a little piece away and let on to be resting and greatly fatigued, which was a lie, but I believed it, for I still thought her honest long after I ought to have begun to doubt her, suspecting that was no way for a high-minded bird to be acting. I followed and followed and followed, making my periodical rushes and getting up and brushing the dust off and resuming the voyage with patient confidence, indeed with a confidence which grew, for I could see by the change of climate and vegetation We were getting up into the high latitudes, and as she'd always looked a little tireder and a little more discouraged after each rush, I judged that I was safe to win in the end, the competition being purely a matter of staying power and the advantage of lying with me from the start because she was lame. Along in the afternoon, I began to feel fatigued myself. Neither of us had had any rest since we first started on the excursion, which was upwards of 10 hours before. Though latterly we'd paused a while after rushes, I letting on being thinking about something else, but neither of us sincere, and both of us waiting for the other to call game, but in no real hurry about it, for indeed, those little evanescent snatches of rest were very grateful to the feelings of us both. It would naturally be so, skirmish along like that ever since dawn and not a bite in the meantime, at least for me, though sometimes she lay on her side fanning herself with a wing and praying for strength to get out of this difficulty, a grasshopper happened along whose time had come, and that was well for her and fortunate. But I had nothing, nothing the whole day. More than once, after I was very tired, I gave up taking her alive and was going to shoot her. But I never did it, although it was my right, for I did not believe I could hit her. And besides, she always stopped and posed when I raised the gun, and this made me suspicious that she knew about me and my marksmanship. So I did not care to expose myself to remarks. I did not get her at all. When she got tired of the game at last, she rose from almost under my hand and flew aloft with the rush and whir of a shell and lit on the highest limb of a great tree and sat down and crossed her legs and smiled down at me and seemed gratified to see me so astonished. I was ashamed and also lost, and it was while wandering the woods, hunting for myself, that I found a deserted log cabin and had one of the best meals there that in my life days I have eaten. The weed-grown garden was full of ripe tomatoes, and I ate them ravenously, though I have never liked them before. Not more than 2 or 3 times since have I tasted anything that was so delicious as those tomatoes. I surfeited myself with them and did not taste another one until I was in middle life. I can eat them now, but do not like the look of them. I suppose we've all experienced a surfeit one time or another. Once, in stress of circumstance, I ate part of a barrel of sardines, there being nothing else at hand. But since then, I have always been able to get along without sardines. And now, Is He Living or Is He Dead? By Mark Twain. I was spending the month of March 1892 at Mentone in the Riviera. At this retired spot, one has all the advantages privately, which are to be had publicly at Monte Carlo and Nice, a few miles further north along. That is to say, one has the flooding sunshine, the balmy air, and the brilliant blue sea, without the marring additions of humans powwowing and fuss and feathers and display. Mentone is quiet, simple, restful, and pretentious. The rich and the gaudy do not come there, as a rule, I mean. The rich do not come there. Now and then a rich man comes, and I presently got acquainted with one of these, partially to disguise him. I will call him Smith. One day in the Hotel des Anglais, at the second breakfast, he exclaimed, "Quick! Cast your eyes on the man going out at the door. Take in every detail of him." "Why? Do you know who he is?" "Yes, he spent several days here before you came. He's an old, retired, very rich silk merchant from Lyons, they say, and I guess he's alone in the world, for he always looks sad and dreamy and doesn't talk with anybody. His name is Theophile McGann." I suppose that Smith would now proceed to justify the large interest in which he had in Monsieur Magan, but instead he dropped into a brown study and was apparently lost to me and to the rest of the world during some minutes. Now and then he passed his fingers through his flossy white hair to assist his thinking, and meantime he allowed his breakfast to go on cooling. At last he said, "No, it's gone. I can't call it back." "Can't call what back?" It's one of Hans Andersen's beautiful little stories, but it's gone from me. Part of it is like this. A child has a caged bird, which it loves, but thoughtlessly neglects. The bird pours out its song unheard and unheeded. But in time, hunger and thirst assail the creature, and its song grows plaintive and feeble, and finally ceases. The bird dies. The child comes and is smitten to the heart with remorse then. The bitter tears and lamentation, it calls its mates, and they bury the bird with elaborate pomp and the tenderest grief, without knowing, poor thing, that it isn't children only who starve poets to death, and then spend enough on their funerals and monuments to have kept them alive and made them easy and comfortable. Here we were interrupted. About 10 that evening, I ran across Smith, and he asked me up to his parlor to help him smoke and drink hot scotch. It was a cozy place, with its comfortable chairs, its cheerful lamps, and its friendly open fire of seasoned olive wood. To make everything perfect, there was a muffled booming of the surf outside. After the second scotch and much lazy and contented chat, Smith said, "Now we are properly primed. I to tell a curious history, and you to listen to it. It has been my secret for many years, a secret between me and three others, but I am going to break the seal now. Are you comfortable?" "Perfectly. Go on." Here follows what he told me. A long time ago, I was a young artist, a very young artist, in fact, and I wandered about the country parts of France, sketching here and sketching there, and was presently joined by a couple of darling young Frenchmen who were the same kind of thing that I was doing. We were as happy as we were poor, or as poor as we were happy. Phrase it to suit yourself. Claude Frere and Carl Bolanger. These are the names of those boys, dear, dear fellows, and the sunniest spirits that have ever laughed at poverty and had a noble good time in all weathers. As we ran hard aground in a Breton village, and an artist poor as ourselves took us in and literally saved us from starving, François Millet.
What?
The great François Millet? Great. He wasn't any greater than we were then. He hadn't any fame, even in his own village. And he was so poor that he hadn't anything to feed us on but turnips. But even turnips failed us sometimes. We four became fast friends, doting friends, inseparable. We painted away together with all our might, piling up stock, but seldom getting rid of any of it. We had lovely times together, but oh my soul, how we were pinched now and then. For a little over 2 years, this thought went on. At last, one day, Claude said, "Boys, we've come to the end. Do you understand that?" "Absolutely to the end. Everybody has struck. There's a league formed against us. I've been all around the village, and it's just as I tell you. They refuse to credit us another cent until all the odds and ends are paid up." This struck us as cold. Every face was blank with dismay. We realized our circumstances were desperate now. There was a long silence. Finally, Millet said with a sigh, "Nothing occurs to me. Nothing. Suggest something, lads." There was no response, unless a mournful silence may be called a response. Carl got up and walked nervously up and down a while. Then he said, "It's a shame. Look at these canvases, stacks and stacks of as good pictures as anybody in Europe paints. I don't care who he is. Yes, and plenty of lounging strangers have said the same, or nearly that anyway, but didn't buy," Millet said. "No matter, they said it, and it's true, too. Look at your Angelus there. Will anybody tell me? Pah, Carl, my Angelus was offered 5 francs for. When? Who offered it? Where is he? Why didn't you take it? Come, don't all speak at once. I thought he would give more. I was sure of it. He looked at it. So I asked him 8. Well, and then he said he would call again. Thunder and lightning. Well, Francois. Oh, I know it was a mistake. I was a fool, boys. I meant for the best. You'll grant me that. And I... Why, certainly, we know that. Bless your dear heart. But don't be a fool again. I wish somebody would come along and offer us a cabbage for it. You'd see. A cabbage. Oh, don't name it. It makes my mouth water. Talk of things less trying. Boy, said Carl, do these pictures lack merit? Answer me that. No. Aren't they of very great and high merit? Answer me that. Yes. Of such great and high merit that, if an illustrious name were attached to them, they would sell at splendid prices. Isn't that so? Certainly it is. Nobody doubts that. But I'm not joking. Isn't it so? Why, of course it's so, and we are not joking, but what of it? What of it? How does that concern us? In this way, comrades, we'll attach an illustrious name to them. The lively conversation stopped. The faces turned inquiringly upon Carl, what kind of riddle might this be? Where was an illustrious name to be borrowed, and who was to borrow it? Carl sat down and said, Now, I have a perfectly serious thing to propose. I think it is the only way to keep us out of the almshouse, and I believe it to be a perfectly sure way. I base this opinion upon certain multitudinous and long-established facts in human history. I believe my project will make us all rich. Rich? You've lost your mind. No, I haven't. Yes, you have. You've lost your mind. What do you call rich? 100,000 francs apiece. He has lost his mind. I knew it. Yes, he has, Carl. Privation has been too much for you. And, Carl, do you want to take a pill and get right to bed? Bandage him first. Bandage his head. And then, no, bandage his heels. His brains have been settling for weeks. I've noticed it. Shut up, said Millet with ostensible severity, and let the boy have his say. Now then, come out with your project. What is it? Well, then, by way of preamble, I will ask you to note this fact in human history, that the merit of many a great artist has never been acknowledged until after he was starved and dead. This has happened so often that I make a bold to found a law upon it. This law, that the merit of every great unknown and neglected artist must and will be recognized, and his pictures climb to the high prices after his death. My project is this. We must cast lots. One of us must die. The remark fell so calmly and so unexpectedly that we almost forgot to jump. Then there was a wild chorus of advice again, medical advice, for the help of Carl's brain. But he waited patiently for the hilarity to calm down and went on again with his project. Yes, one of us must die to save the others and himself. We will cast lots. The one chosen shall be illustrious. All of us shall be rich. Hold still now. Hold still. Don't interrupt. I'll tell you. I know what I'm talking about. Here is the idea. During the next 3 months, the one who is told shall die shall paint with all his might, enlarge his stock all he can, not pictures, no, skeleton sketches, studies, parts of studies, fragments of studies, a dozen dabs of the brush on each, meaningless, of course, but his, with his cipher on them, turn out 50 a day to contain some peculiarity or mannerism easily detectable as his. They're the things that sell, you know, and are collected at fabulous prices for the world's museum after a great man is gone. We'll have a ton of them ready, a ton. And all the time, the rest of us will be busy supporting the Morbidon and working Paris and the dealers, preparation for the coming event, you know, and when everything is hot and just right, we'll spring the death on them and have the notorious funeral. You get the idea? No, at least not. What? Not quite. Don't you see? The man doesn't really die. He changes his name and vanishes. We bury a dummy and cry over it with all the world to help. And I, but he wasn't allowed to finish. Everybody broke out in a rousing hurrah of applause and all jumped up and capered about the room and fell on each other's necks in transports of gratitude and joy. For hours we talked over the great plan without ever feeling hungry, and at last, when all the details had been arranged satisfactorily, we cast lots, and Millet was elected. elected to die, as we called it. Then we scrape together those things which one never parts with until he's betting with them against the future wealth, keepsake trinkets and such like, and we pawn for enough to furnish us a frugal farewell supper and breakfast, and leave us a few francs over for travel, and a steak of turnips and such for Malaya to live on for a few days. Next morning, early, three of us cleared out straight away after breakfast, on foot, of course. Each of us carried a dozen of Malaya's small pictures, proposing to market them. Carl struck for Paris, where he would start working the building up Malaya's name against the coming great day. Claude and I were to separate and scatter over France. Now, it will surprise you to know what an easy and comfortable thing we had. I walked 2 days before I began business. Then I began to sketch a villa on the outskirts of a big town, because I saw the proprietor standing on an upper veranda. He came down to look on. I thought he would. I worked swiftly, intending to keep him interested. Occasionally he fired off a little ejaculation of appropriation, and by he spoke up with enthusiasm, said I was a master. I put down my brush and reached into my satchel, fetched out a Malay, and pointed to the cipher in the corner. I said proudly, "I suppose you recognize that. Well, he taught me. I should think I ought to know my trade." The man looked guiltily embarrassed and was silent. I said sorrowfully, "You don't mean to intimate that you don't know the cipher of Francois Malay?" Of course he didn't know that cipher, but he was the gratefulest man you ever saw, just the same, for being let out of an uncomfortable place on such easy terms. He said, "No, why, it's a Malay, sure enough. I don't know what I could have been thinking. Of course I recognize it now." Next he wanted to buy it, but I said although I wasn't rich, I wasn't that poor. However, at last I let him have it for 800 francs. 800. Yes, Malay would have sold it for a pork chop. Yes, I got 800 francs for that little thing. I wish I could get it back for 80,000, but that time's gone by. I made a very nice picture of that man's house and wanted to offer it to him for 10 francs, but that wouldn't answer, seeing I was the pupil of such a master, so I sold it to him for 100. I let the 800 francs straight to Malay from that town and struck out again the next day. But I didn't walk. No, I rode. I have ridden ever since. I sold one picture every day and never tried to sell two. I always said to my customer, "I'm a fool to sell a picture of Francois Malay's at all, for that man is not going to live 3 months, and when he dies, his pictures can't be had for love or money." I took care to spread that little fact as far as I could and prepare the world for the event. I take credit to myself for our plan of selling the pictures. It was mine. I suggested it that last evening when we were laying out our campaign, and all three of us agreed to give it a good fair trial before giving up for some other. It succeeded with all of us. I walked only 2 days. Claude walked too, both afraid to make Malay celebrated too close to home. But Carl walked only half a day, the bright, conscienceless and rascal, and after that he traveled like a duke. Every now and then we got in with a country editor and started an item around through the press, not an item announcing a new painter had been discovered, but an item which led on that everybody knew Francois Malay, not an item praising him in any way, but merely a word concerning the present condition of the master. Sometimes hopeful, sometimes despondent, but always tinged with fears for the worse. We always marked these paragraphs and sent the papers to all the people who had bought pictures from us. Carl was soon in Paris, and he worked things with a high hand. He made friends with the correspondents and got Malay's condition reported to England and all over the continent and America and everywhere. And at the end, 6 weeks from the start, we met We three met in Paris and called halt and stopped sending back to Malay for additional pictures. The boom was so high and everything was so ripe that we saw it would be a mistake not to strike now, right away, without waiting any longer. So we wrote Malay to go to bed and begin to waste away pretty fast, for we should like him to die in 10 days if he could get ready. Then we figured up and found that among us we had sold 85 small pictures in study. We had 69,000 francs to show for it. Carl had made the last sell, and the most brilliant one of all. He sold the Angelus for 2,200 francs. How we did glorify him, not foreseeing a day that was coming when France would struggle to own it and a stranger would capture it for 550,000 cash. We had a wind-up champagne dinner that night, and next day Claude and I packed up and went off to nurse Malay through his last days and keep busybodies out of the house and send daily bulletins to Carl in Paris for publication in the papers of several continents for the information of a waiting world. The sad end came at last, and Carl was there in time to help in the final mournful rites. You remember that great funeral, what a stir it made all over the globe, and how the illustrious of two worlds came to attend it and testify their sorrow. We four, still inseparable, carried the coffin and would allow none to help. And we were right about that, because it hadn't anything in it but a wax figure, and any other coffin bearers would have found fault with the weight. Yes, we same old four who had lovingly shared privation together in the hard times, now gone forever, carried the coffin. Which four? We four. For Malay helped carry his own coffin in disguise, you know, disguised as a distant relative. Astonishing. But true just the same. Well, you remember how the pictures went up? Money? We didn't know what to do with it. There was a man in Paris today who has owned 70 Malay pictures. He paid us 2 million francs for them. And as for the bushels of sketches and studies which Malay shoveled out during the 6 weeks that we were on the road, well, it would astonish you to know the figure we still sell them at nowadays. And that is when we consent to let one go. It's a wonderful history, perfectly wonderful. Yes, it amounts to that. Whatever became of Malay? Can you keep a secret? I can. Do you remember the man I called to your attention in the dining room today? That was Francois Malay. Great Scott, yes. For once they didn't starve a genius to death and then put into other pockets the reward he should have had himself. This songbird was not allowed to pipe out its heart unheard and then be paid with the cold pomp of a big funeral. We looked out for that. I hope you enjoyed these two short stories and Reading with the Classics. Hope you have a wonderful evening. Good night.